Hey, Andrea.
Hi, Dan, you're back.
So I'm back. Did you miss me?
Absolutely.
How about you, Kevin?
Absolutely.
Oh, you're such silver tongue liars, both of you. But in any case, I wanted to do me a favor. I wanted to provide a little historical context to what we're going to be talking about tonight. Can I do that?
Mm-hmm. Oh. Roll along.
Okay. The year is 1978, and Hollywood is all abuzz with the rebirth of the classic movie musical, a rebirth originally kicked off a couple of years ago by Twin Hits, starring John Travolta, Saturday Night Fever, and Grease. Universal, not one to turn its back on a trend, offers its own addition to the Renaissance, a big-budget, surefire production that, while it doesn't have Travolta, does have the next best thing in featuring the soundtrack stars of Saturday Night Fever, the Bee Gees, and, more importantly, music by the kings of rock and roll, the Beatles. That film was Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and it was a box office bomb. The guiding hands at Universal shake off the shock, check their inboxes to be sure there aren't any pink slips there, and swear they will never make that mistake again. 2 years later, Universal tries again with a big-budget, surefire production that, while it doesn't have Travolta, does have the next best thing in his co-star from Grease, Olivia Newton-John, and more importantly, music by, well, not necessarily the kings, but they were reigning over a happy little duchy at that point, shall we say, the Electric Light Orchestra. Oh, and it'd also be Gene Kelly's last film. So there's that, too. We're talking here, of course, about the film that made roller disco a permanent part of the American landscape, Xanadu. And we'll be talking about it on this episode of Mighty Movie Podcast's Temple of Bad. To the Temple of Bad, where we celebrate films so awful they're practically a religious experience. I'm Dan Persons.
I'm Andrea Lipinski.
I'm Kevin Laudervale.
And yes, this time around we are doing Xanadu from 1980, starring Olivia Newton-John, Gene Kelly, and Michael Beck, and featuring the music of the Electric Light Orchestra, Jeff Lynne's outfit. And just so you know, this is a film that is available on Netflix, because why should we be the only ones to suffer? So, before we do anything, let's give a little listen to the trailer and get some idea of what we are in for.
Chef, there's no cream in the soup, just like he asked for.
No, wait, that was wrong.
Close.
Yeah, I know. Hold on, wait a second here. There we go.
Open your eyes and hear the magic. Universal Pictures announces the most dazzling romantic musical fantasy in years, Xanadu. Starring Olivia Newton-John, Michael Beck, and Gene Kelly.
Xanadu,
It's a love story about a boy and girl from two very different worlds whom no one can keep apart. It's a spectacular entertainment that will transport you beyond your dreams. Xanadu, where time stops and the magic never ends. Xanadu.
And this film was Kevin's choice, and I think at this point we have to officially dub Kevin the master of the likable bad film. The last time around, when it was your call, Kevin, you did Mighty Peking Man, and it turned out that that was actually, for a bad film, a pretty decent film all told, particularly if you understood where it was coming from. And while this isn't quite as good as that, let's face it, it is a bad film. There are certain aspects of it that, at least when you're looking at it from the outside, give one hope and make it a more interesting exercise. So, Kevin, before we do anything, explain yourself. Why did you decide to go for this one?
I'd seen it in the theater back in the day when I was very young, and I hadn't seen it since. And I didn't have warm, fuzzy, glowing feelings about it. But I thought, well, you know, it's been ridiculed for decades. They made a cheesy Broadway musical version of it. Well, let's just see this and see if it holds up or if it completely flops. It's a movie that I really wanted to love. If you had come to me and said, hey, I got a movie for you. It's a musical. Hey, love musicals. It's Gene Kelly's last non-documentary role. Love Gene Kelly. It's got Olivia Newton-John. Oh, she was so cute in Grease. It's all about the entertainment business. Oh, fantastic. She plays a muse. Oh, sounds awesome. It's got music by ELO. I'm so there. But this is a film that is so much less than the sun of all its parts. It's so disappointing. I remember now. I know now why I didn't remember it that fondly. Mm-hmm. I didn't remember it that much. I think I tried to block it out.
So by your description, it does seem that it has quite a lot in common with our prior viewing of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
All these films look so good on paper, and so many people must have worked hard. There must have been union crews and lighting technicians and sound people, but it just doesn't come together.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And yes, I mean, this is the thing where you go, holy shit, this looks great. And let me just throw in a few other things, because you did mention Gene Kelly, Olivia Newton-John, Electric Light Orchestra. It doesn't stop there. There's actually a brief shot by the satirical band The Tubes. There's an animated sequence by Don Bluth. Wilfred Hyde White makes not really a brief appearance. It's a voice performance that he gives, but he's there. And Sandahl Bergman of Conan actually shows up at one point. So you're going, holy shit, you know, this is amazing. And yes, it's exactly as you say, Kevin, the sum of the parts is so much lesser than all those parts. Let me just throw in here and let me just set up the plot so people understand what's going on. Now, the one other big star that we have not mentioned yet is Michael Beck, because it turned out to be such a big star after all.
Oh, that was funny. Yeah, okay, go on.
But Michael Beck plays Sonny Malone, a graphic artist working for a record company, who one day gets kissed by a beautiful roller skating muse played by Olivia Newton-John. And being the now inspired artist he naturally is, he is possessed with the urge to express his creativity in the most logical way possible by opening up a roller disco in the abandoned Pan Pacific Auditorium in Los Angeles. Makes perfect sense. And so, Andrea, you know, I hate... You know, I really do try to avoid indulging in spoilers if I can. But I really have to say now that I've just spoiled the film, because that's the entire plot. of the movie.
That is basically the, I mean, the plot of the movie on paper could be summed up like that in just a few sentences.
That's it. He wants to open a roller disco, and he does. That's it.
But there are nuances.
Are there?
There are nuances in the form of, you know, musical numbers, some which work better than others.
Yeah.
And in the form of, like, okay, you've got that kind of very bare basic plot. And then you have times when on the screen, I would look at the screen and I would see Gene Kelly, known for Singing in the Rain, standing next to Michael Beck, known for The Warriors, Come Out and Play, eh? And I would think there is one of America's greatest actors standing next to one of America's worst.
Yeah. You know, here's the thing. I mean, Andrea says there are nuances. There are musical numbers and all of that. But really, Kevin, Sleight does not describe this film. This feels like the only reason it exists is that you can't just charge people to sit in a theater and not have something up on the screen.
Yeah, let's just cut straight to the chase, which is the people who made this film clearly revere musicals. They got Gene Kelly out of retirement. There's references to other musicals, other movies throughout their production numbers. But I think that the love of musicals was their undoing. What these guys created we're going to call the good parts only musical, which is boy meets girl, musical number, boy gets girl. There's something missing in that film, in this film. And that something is conflict, which is the essence of drama. There is one conflict. He can't be with her because he's immortal and she's a muse. That lasts about 4 minutes.
Yeah.
That is settled by a literal deus ex machina. And other than that, there are no obstacles for our heroes to overcome. At no point is anyone turned away, rejected, said no to. I had an editor who once told me there's really only one story. That story is things get worse. You see that in hour-long dramas, in sitcoms, in movies. Nothing ever gets worse for our characters. There's that great scene where they're celebrating the completion of 1 week's work on Xanadu with champagne and all that. In any other movie, something would have come along at that moment to stop them. Oh, you don't have the right building permit. There's a family of endangered species living in the building. Now, the very next scene is buying clothes for Gene Kelly. And after that, it's Gene Kelly on the phone. We're opening tomorrow. That's it. What happened to the second act where problems have to be overcome? I think this is what ultimately doomed Xanadu is it's the good parts only. This is a movie for people who fast forward through the talky parts of other movies.
You don't have to actually fast forward. The problem is there's no second act. There's no third act either. This movie is all first act. This movie is essentially what should have been in the first half hour.
And Kevin, you have a great point about the conflict, because there is the perfect vehicle for conflict. Oh, my God, that's the muse that I was in love with 40 years ago. I want her. Let's fight to the death.
Yeah.
I'm Gene Kelly. I have the charisma of Gene Kelly. You are Michael Beck, and you have the charisma of a damp dish rag. I win. But no, Gene Kelly just steps aside. What's that?
Didn't he even not recognize her? Didn't we just see her in a flashback sequence, B, like a book they were paging through, and then she shows up, and is he going to go, oh my God, I know you? No, he doesn't do it. Is he not recognize her?
I don't know. Is he supposed to have early onset Alzheimer's?
Yeah.
Or is it just going to be, wow, you look exactly like a woman who I loved 40 years ago. Well, clearly, since the way that time and logic works, you can't be her. You must be a relative or a descendant of her. But, I mean, for God's sake, it's her.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just throw in here, because the plot is so slight, that means that all we've got are essentially the set pieces, the music, the dancing, whatever there is. And you know what? That would be fine if those were good, but they're not. You know, and let me just set up, I think, what is sort of the prototypical example of that for the prototype. typical example for the film. For me, it was the sequence where Gene Kelly, having met Michael Beck for the second time, he takes him back to his gorgeous mansion and shows him around, and they set up the idea that Michael Beck is going to look for a place to for Gene Kelly to open up a club. That is, of course, is going to be the Pan Pacific Auditorium. But it's been set up that they both know Olivia Newton-John. And so Gene Kelly sits down, and now he goes on a nostalgia trip where he remembers from back in the past when Olivia Newton-John was actually the singer of the big band orchestra that he led. So the idea is this. Gene Kelly is sitting in the foreground, reminiscing. In the background, we see the big band with, and it's not Gene Kelly who's playing Gene Kelly, it's some other actor there, and Olivia Newton-John, and she's singing while the band is playing. This is a whole long sequence where Olivia Newton-John is singing while Gene Kelly is reacting. The problem with this is that this is set in his mansion, and the room they've set it in is as large as a football field. And for some reason, they've decided to put the bandstand in perspective, superimposed, in the back of the room.
It's so very strangely shot.
It's very strangely shot so that the stuff that you should be watching is all the way in the back. Meantime, Gene Kelly is in the foreground, and I can pretty much guess how this worked was that they sat him in the chair, played the soundtrack, and just said to him, okay, react to the music. And Gene Kelly is a good enough actor, but, you know, he can only go so far. And so basically what he does is try to mime a clarinet at a few points, tries to sing along a few of the lyrics, but very clearly doesn't know all the lyrics. So his lips start flapping sort of ineffectually after a while. And that goes on for a while.
I think it's supposed to be him trying to remember.
Yeah, well, yeah. Visually. And this is the other thing about that, is that that's all the way in the background. And so, I mean, for me, this film is like great Broadway musical theater in that I could never afford the orchestra seats. And so I would have to, if I went to musical theater, I had to buy the third balcony seats, which appears to be where they place the camera for all the dance numbers. For some reason, the director, Robert Greenwald, seems to have some sort of fear of committing to his dancers. It's like, ooh, stay your distance over there. So.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you were looking at Gene Kelly in that scene. I was trying to see what was going on behind
exactly.
him.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And I was just kind of squinting in the background and trying to see what was going on with, you know, with Olivia Newton-John and the guy who's playing the young Gene Kelly, who you identified as, you know, some other guy.
Yeah.
According to IMDb, she married some other guy.
Did she?
Apparently she spent too much time with him.
All that time on the backstand in the grandstand in the background.
I guess he must have impressed her. But yeah, I mean, I'm not like a film student, but even I was like, what's wrong with this picture? I can't see what I'm supposed to see. I'm listening to the music, but I'm squinting and I'm like, what is this thing? I want to see the thing.
It's all ghosty. It's superimposed and it's see-through. And there's a lot of that in the film. Yeah. There's a scene where she's rollerblading and that sort of see-through ghosty. It's supposed to create an aura of the supernatural, I guess. But really, it just makes me need glasses even sooner.
Well, here's the thing about that is that the special effects, and this was a weird thing because this may be the last time that a special effects company got their credit in at the beginning of the film rather than the end. The special effects were done by R. Greenberg Associates, which is a New York-based company. And they were known at that point for what they were calling computer-assisted filmmaking, which I take to mean this is a little too soon for actual digital processes. So I'm presuming that that means like motion control and what was called slit scan effects at that point. And
I think it means they must have just watched Tron over and over again.
Well, yeah. You know, here's the thing is that it means putting a glow around a lot of shit. The thing is that what they were best known for, I think, at this point were graphics effects. The big credit at around this time were the opening titles for Superman.
Wow.
That sort of stuff. So, you know, I mean, what they were doing here is like putting glows around Olivia Newton-John and doing stuff where people turn into streaks of light. The problem with that was that a lot of that stuff looked like the kind of stuff that you get before the film starts rather than during the film. You know, there's one point at the beginning of the film where Olivia Newton-John is with all of the other muses and they all turn into streaks of light and sort of flash up past the clouds. And I was really expecting at some point that somebody was going to tell me not to talk or text during the film.
Hmm.
You know? And the other thing that they do a lot of here is sort of a light glow around people. It's supposed to be like an aura or something like that, but they lay it in really, really heavy on this. It's not a subtle effect at all. And so it's not so much an ethereal look as, holy shit, get away from her. She's radioactive.
If it's supposed to be a halo, that's the wrong religion. Olympian pagans.
Well, that
here.
Too. The other thing, and I don't know whether this this bothered either of you. Well, let me ask you this. The wipes.
Oh.
Those transitions. Well, for one thing, the only person who should have been doing wipes at this point was George Lucas in one of the Star Wars films, you know. Wipes should otherwise be verboten. Otherwise, but the thing is, it's not only that they did this sort of Venetian blind sort of thing where the picture breaks up into vertical slats and then drops away or falls forward, along with this annoying sound effect like.
Right. They were called like slit wipes or shutter wipes or something like that. It was just very affected. I mean, it's like it draws your attention to the wipe. Like, look what I'm doing. I learned how to do this in film tech class.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with wipes, in my opinion, as an aesthetic tool. And you can see them in Star Wars. But yeah, the fact that you make a comic book out of them, I think it's another attempt at the supernatural. You'll remember the very, very beginning is the Universal airplane going around the Earth. And the airplane becomes a jet and eventually becomes a UFO. They're trying to draw attention to the specialness and otherworldly qualities of this film because, frankly, their actors can't project that.
What are you saying?
By the way, as you mentioned, during the Universal logo, they play around with it. Here again, it was one of the older Universal logos that they were using, where the plane circles the Earth. That's the original logo. And then they do several other different, more modern planes and all of that.
Very similar shtick to Sergeant Pepper, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh.
So, I would have liked to have been like, you know, in the screening room with the Universal executives where they're sitting down to watch this film for the first time and they see that trick with the Universal logo. And I can imagine all of them going, oh, shit.
Yeah, but then they can go, oh, no, this one has a UFO. This one's going to be different. This is going to be different than the other one. Because that's the way the technology is going to progress from planes to jets to UFOs, I guess.
I want to talk about one of the other sequences here, which is one of the other standout sequences, not for good reasons. It's done to a film called Suddenly. And Kevin, as you mentioned, they are trying to, like, you know, take the good parts of musical films. This is very clearly supposed to be keyed off of the Lucky Star sequence from Singing in the Rain. It takes place in what's supposed to be a recording studio. And it's supposed to be a roller skate ballet. But wow, I mean, Sonny sets up the thing. He takes Olivia Newton-John into this place, and he says, this is a special recording studio for the rock artists. They project pictures, okay? And by projecting pictures, he means that this is a huge warehouse with a number of physical automated sets that pop up as you move around it. And I you know, for one thing, I don't know exactly which rock groups are taking inspiration from a desert oasis and a railroad crossing, but
there's also a New York skyline.
And
talking about singing in the rain, there's actually umbrellas and rain.
Yeah.
This is one of those numbers, and there's actually a couple of times in this where I felt that, okay, going back to, I know Andrea hates it when I do this, let's compare this to Singing in the Rain, shall we?
Oh, my heart.
There's one sequence, and this happens in a couple of Gene Kelly movies, where I always thought that basically the action stops.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think in Singing in the Rain, Gene Kelly is describing to the studio executive a beautiful scene he has in mind. And so the action stops, a sequence takes place, and then the action starts up again.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the big Broadway rhythm.
Yeah, exactly.
Dance sequence. Yeah.
And so that's what they were trying for in this, clearly. But first of all, the action never starts up again.
Well, it isn't as if there was any action to stop to begin with. But go on.
There's no logical explanation for why these three-dimensional things exist in a recording studio. There is, in fact, for those of you who are constant listeners, I think that's why our last episode, the one I recorded, was so bad, because I was on a desert island. I was running around. I shouldn't have done that. I was using coconuts.
By the way, when I'm a rock artist recording his work, I do want those automated set pieces to make as much noise as possible.
Also, the lights. Why is it in movies when people turn on the lights, the big arc lights, it's like, kong, 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 kong.
Well, there's something to, I mean, that is the sound that the switches make and the arc lights make when they are turned on in a movie studio. The arc lights are they're actually created by generating, this is probably not true, or they may actually be using this, but it's actually an arc that crosses from one graphite point to another. And when you start it up, it does that sort of sound. So that is real for a movie studio.
Not for a recording studio.
I mean, that is the part of the logic that we have to examine here, okay? This being a special studio that is supposed to inspire artists, this is one of the most ridiculous concepts in this movie, and that is saying a lot. Okay, how exactly do the music groups record in here? There is no recording equipment, and everything that's there is just making noise or getting in the way. And how are musicians going to be inspired by a rooftop, a cityscape, a desert oasis, strong winds, rain, a steam-powered locomotive, and smoke? What does that have to do with inspiring anyone?
By the way, Andrea, there is one piece of equipment in there. There is actually a reel-to-reel recorder. Tape.
Where are the microphones, Dan?
I know. I said there was one.
Well, if it's a reel-to-reel and it's not connected to anything, that doesn't help us. By the way, for the trivia fans in the house, who sings Suddenly with Olivia Newton-John? Who's the guy singing? Because it's not Bright Eyes.
Yeah, definitely not. Okay, give it to us.
Cliff Richard.
Oh,
good Lord. Another one. Jeez, I missed that one.
Mm-hmm.
Throw that in with the tubes and Fee Waybill. Before we go any further, because I think we can work our way over to the grand finale in quick time, but let's talk about the good things about
it. Okay, let's hear it then.
There are good things, and the thing that I wanted to bring up is the Don't Walk Away sequence, which is actually an animated sequence. It was done by Don Bluth. This is not too long after Bluth had walked out of Disney Studios and taken a number of artists with him and started up his own studio. And so, you know, they were still a small operation. From what I understand, Bluth did the animation on the sequence himself. And it really has nothing to do with the story. You can say it has something to do in that right before the sequence, Sunny is asking, Kira is her name?
Well, that's her. It's her nom de human.
Her nom de skate.
Well, she almost nice. She almost says her real name is Terpsichore.
Yeah, right. The reason why was because nobody involved with actually reading the script could say Terpsichore. Yeah. So, but he's asking her who she is, and she keeps being evasive, and so that sort of leads into this sequence where an animated Sunny is chasing after an animated Kira. But that's as far as it goes. But it's a beautifully done sequence. And it's at this point, knowing what Don Bluth had left and what he was trying to get to, it's thrilling to see him working and holding out the promise of what he could do. He blew the promise eventually. But at this point, it's a wonderful sequence, and it's got a very good song by ELO to back it up. So that was one of the worthwhile things.
Except that Sunny, as a fish, is wearing the same vest he wears all the time. Kira, as a bird, is wearing the same boots or leg warmers that she wears throughout the film. I was reminded of Aladdin. Basically, seeing the vest and everything like that.
You don't want them to be naked, do you?
Hang on. There is a vital difference here. The animated segment proves that both the fish and the bird are far more expressive actors than Michael Beck. Okay, because when Sonny Malone is a fish and a bird, the expression on the face actually changes once in a while.
Yep. In their defense, Andrea, if Michael Beck and Olivia Newton-John had artists working on them for months, they probably could have reached that level of expression as well. I'm just saying.
So. I don't know if you're winning that argument.
Yeah, maybe not.
I'd have to rewatch The Warriors to see if Michael Beck has the ability to change expressions. Because most of the time he just looks like he's just been hit in the face with something and just gobsmacked.
Which is pretty much the way it is here, too. Andrea, what about you? Do you want to point out something nice?
Oh, something nice. Yeah. Ah, hang on. Well, let me look. Let's see.
You want to think about it a sec?
Let's see. Nimrod and Olivia Newton-John. I was calling him Nimrod by that point in my notes. You know what? I mean, look, I liked the scene where, Gene Kelly and Olivia Newton-John danced.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that, once she moved into the front part of the frame where we could actually see her.
And they stopped the superimposition.
And they stopped that. And they actually, danced together. I mean, I thought that that was, really sweet. And then I liked the song. I mean, in addition to me going around for weeks after this stupid, stupid movie singing Xanadu to myself, I would occasionally, not as often, but I would occasionally sing that song whenever you're away from me. Because that was also like a catchy song, and I liked the way that they danced to it, and Gene Kelly could still dance, and I hear that he like privately choreographed that number,
mm-hmm.
and just recorded that with her, and I mean that was sweet, but it's like every part of the film where something nice and sweet like that would warm my heart would just make the pain worse later. When she's, yelling at Zeus and going, I've never felt this way about anyone before. Like, what? What do you mean?
You've never felt anything. Bullshit.
What do you mean? What you feel for that Nimrod, you've never felt for anyone before? What about Gene Kelly?
Andrea,
yes.
Truly you are the cruelest note taker.
I get a little harsh sometimes.
Yeah, I know. By the way, to Olivia Newton-John's credit, she keeps up quite well with Gene Kelly.
Yeah, I mean, she does. I mean, look, I mean, she dances well there, which is good because she's supposed to be the muse of dance and spends most of her time roller skating at 5 miles an hour. But the fact is that when she does need to dance, she can.
Mm-hmm.
And that dance I actually enjoyed, as opposed to some later in the film.
We'll get to that presently. Kevin, how about you?
Well, first of all, we've got to give Gene Kelly major props. Yeah, well, he was 68 years old when he made this film.
Yeah.
And he spends a lot of it on roller skates. I hope I can move around on roller skates.
I would like to chip into that because, I mean, in the All Over the World sequence, which is the other sequence where apparently he's on roller skates, I wasn't really sure it was him. It may have been a double. In that case, he's definitely on roller skates during the Xanadu number.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
He doesn't hoof it as much as he did in his earlier days. But at the very beginning of that scene we've been talking about with the big band number with the superimposed business, when you see him just get up out of the chair and walk across the room, you can tell that's Gene Kelly.
Yeah,
nobody moves like him. Yeah. And throughout all – here's – my major blessing to him. He has a big smile on his face throughout this movie. Even when he's being required to do the stupidest stuff, like in All Over the World, he's basically a full-size pinball in a pinball machine. He's having a great time. He's having fun. He's smiling. I don't think it's forced. He just loves the dance and whatever dance they give him to do, he does.
Kevin?
Okay.
Remember, always dignity.
That's right. That's right.
Kevin, I disagree with the fact that he was enjoying himself.
Okay.
I think that the fact that he was smiling and laughing and looking good in the scene where he's in the giant pinball machine and in the scene where he has to try on 75 ridiculous outfits, the fact that he's smiling and with his eyes twinkling just proves what an excellent actor he is.
Yeah. He's a trooper, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, he must be.
Give him credit. He showed up to work and he worked.
Rosé game. I like a couple of things. I love the opening number, I'm Alive. As somebody who grew up in Los Angeles and I've seen the murals in Venice Beach, seeing essentially one of those murals come to life. And the dancing, I think, is really nice in that number. The girls, the nine muses, and their little peasant blouses. And there's Sandel Bergman, wonderful dancer. You may have seen her in All That Jazz, as well as Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah.
I think it's a great number. I like the tune. The soundtrack to this movie is great. If you just turn off the visuals or just buy the CD, I love ELO. The tunes are catchy.
Mm-hmm.
While you're talking about the soundtrack, one of the things, and, you know, I had put this up on Facebook because I had started watching this film just to get a taste of it. So I started watching it about a month or so ago. And when this happened, it essentially made me cry. One of the better songs and one of the songs that I really remembered from the film was Magic, which is not, I think, one of the ELO songs. It's an Olivia Newton-John song. And those were written by, I don't remember who wrote those songs, but it wasn't Jeff Lynne doing those. But it is a lovely song with some interesting blues notes to it. And, you know, I was really taken with it. And what do they do with it? They use it as background music for some of the most atrocious dialogue ever.
Well, yeah, I mean, it does kind of undermine, yeah. And Magic was one of the, you know, the best sellers. I mean, that was a really hit song.
Yeah.
According to IMDb, it was performed by Olivia Newton-John, words and music by John Farrar.
Okay, there you go.
And I mean, that was, yeah, I mean, like Magic, and you know, was one of the big hits. And, you know, of course, Xanadu was a big hit. But I mean, there was some, you know, very good music in this. And yeah, I mean, you're hearing that music and you just want them to shut up.
Yeah, really?
Stop talking. I can't hear the pretty song because you two idiots are having this stupid conversation.
One of the other things I really like about the movie is, well, you can say that it's a time capsule of its times. And I'm not talking about the roller disco. I'm talking about the use of one of my favorite buildings of all time, the Pan Pacific Auditorium, which was, I think, either burned down or was torn down about 10 years after this was made. It's such a wonderful Art Deco, streamlined, modern building. It is reproduced in Florida at, is it Disney MGM Studios?
Disney MGM Studios. Also now in Los Angeles, the opening, the entry gates over at Disney California Adventure also replicate the Pan Pacific Auditorium now.
Just such a beautiful building. Yeah. I just love watching. I love being able to see it. It's like, I think that and the Bradbury Building, which we see in Blade Runner and a few other movies, are probably some of my favorite buildings from Los Angeles. And it's just good to see them live and big and in person.
By the way, just as a tangential here, one of the things that gets the plot going is that Sonny is supposed to be doing a giant blow-up of an album cover. The album cover features the Pan Pacific Auditorium, and in front of it is Olivia Newton-John. Sonny recognizes it, and so he goes to the photographer and talks to him about it. And one of the things that had me on the floor was the photographer saying, be careful with that, that's my best photograph. And I'm going, oh boy. Well, I guess this record company is really scraping bottom then, because it's an atrocious... at least the way it's composed. I mean, the Pan Pacific Auditorium looks great, but Olivia Newton-John is just sort of slapped on the front corner, falling off the edge of the right corner there. So,
excuse me, Dan, she happened to skate into frame.
Yes, that's right. Forgive me.
And by the way, the photographer says, I was just taking all these pictures all morning and she happened to skate into that one. How many pictures? You were standing in front of a building. And how many pictures did you need to take in a row until she skated in front of it?
Catch the light. That's another thing about...
Definitely, she just skated in front rather than, say, being rubber cemented on by some artist's assistant.
That's another cultural mark of the times is Sonny's job. Sonny's job is he paints bigger versions of record album covers so that they can be hung as promotional advertisements at things like Tower Records and stuff like that. Something we just don't see anymore.
No longer necessary.
Yeah, job that's gone away.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, you know, I feel strangely happy about that.
Okay, so...
that his job doesn't exist anymore. Take that, you telegraph operator.
Okay, so we have been putting this off long enough. Let's talk about the big closing finale, the Xanadu number. And I say big closing finale. I use that advisedly because it sure ain't big and it isn't even, strictly speaking, closing. So,
wait a second. You don't want to address the other musical number?
Go. Which one?
The you've got your peanut butter in my chocolate? No, you have your chocolate in my peanut butter musical number?
The dancing number, the dueling bandstands number you're talking about?
The musical collage that no one was waiting for.
Car crash? The musical car crash?
No? Musical car crash, yeah.
Said, I love 40s music, I love 80s music, let's put them together. I mean, I just think, yeah, there were good musical numbers in this picture, and that was not one of them.
No.
I was like, who was waiting for this? Who was clamoring for this to happen?
The only thing that I can say worthwhile about it is that this is the sequence that features the tubes.
It is, but this was before they hit it big with She's a Beauty.
Yeah.
So you're not really getting
the tubes. I'll grant you that. Yeah. You know,
you're just getting that the tubes were weird and they had weird outfits and that they tied women up with electrical wire. Some kind of really strange scene going on there.
Yeah, I wondered about that. I also wondered, getting back to the Xanadu number, about the acrobat the aerialist who shows up spinning in one shot. You know, which doesn't look so much whimsical as kinky at that point.
Well, I mean, look, the dancing number was a latticework mélange of two genres that didn't necessarily belong together, being smushed together.
Yeah.
Once you get to the Xanadu final number, then you've got like, and let's throw in this, and let's throw in some country western, and let's throw in some 40s tap dancing, and let's throw in, and every time they throw in something else, I'd be like, can we get back to Xanadu, please?
Well, here's the thing about the closing Xanadu sequence for me, is that it takes place in the club. The club essentially boils down to this one large space with a roller rink and some sort of turntable stage altar in the center of it. Now, we know what the space is like. There are actually a couple of shots where the camera pulls back. We can see the entire length of the space in one shot. So why is it that anytime it goes in closer, I am not sure where the fuck I am in that place?
Huh. Well, I mean, that's like the least of its problems. But yeah, I mean, I do see that. I mean, my question was, are all of these people supposed to be performers? Are any of them paying customers?
They're supposed to be civilians, I think. They are highly choreographed civilians.
They're civilians who all paid to get in and all happen to dress alike and all happen to know the same musical numbers and have them prepared.
Yep, you know.
All right.
Andrea, you just got to lock into the whimsy of the sequence. That's all.
You know, there are musicals in which I can suspend my disbelief. This one, not so much.
How are you going to get from one side of the stage space to the other one without being mowed down by Autobahn rolls?
Well, also,
yeah, you know, pity the poor bastard who wants to get a couple of drinks, you know.
Oh, please. No, I mean, it's like this place was designed by somebody with attention deficit disorder. I mean, you're like, well, let's see, I could go around in a circle. Oh, wait, I could stop here and look at the people who are on a tightrope 2 feet off the ground. Oh, I could stop here and look at this. I could stop here and look at this. But every place you stop, you'd get run over. Every time you stop, someone would come plowing in from behind you. I mean, look, I have been on regular roller skating rinks and constantly fallen down and had people crash into me. And that was without all these other distractions in the middle and people leaping over each other and people twirling in the air and all this other stuff going on.
This is neither a 1940s nightclub nor a 1980s club nightclub. It's the 1960s happening. It's Burning Man.
Nowhere near Burning Man, because Burning Man is a lot more spontaneous in what goes on. And here is the other thing for me, is that the sequence begins with Gene Kelly leading a mass of people in sort of a roller ballet around the track. And it's done to this sort of like heavy boom, 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 boom sort of drum beat. You know, it's
according to the soundtrack.
Yes.
That is called Drum Dreams by ELO.
Drum Dreams. Okay, so it's ELO, but it's a really heavy rhythm. Everybody is moving in synchronization to the beat, clapping their hands, moving along forward, and it doesn't strike me here again as a wonderful night out as much as Triumph of the Will.
That's what I in my notes I wrote, the choreographed stomping and clapping of the Xanadu number makes me think of a cult initiation. This isn't a good time, a fun time for a Saturday night. This is, yeah, Triumph of the Will, and let's follow the master, and let's do whatever. Oh, my God. It's freaky.
If only this had been the first half hour of the film, and then suddenly Olivia Newton-John rose up and took out daggers and started killing people. Turned out she wasn't the muse of dance. She was, like, Satan's minion, and the movie took an entirely different left turn. Now that might have been interesting.
Kevin, you know what? That's actually the opening sequence of Blade, or close to it.
Are we writing this? No, wait. I know. We have to merge Xanadu with Logan's Run. Because remember, Logan's Run had all the people in the carousel going around in a circle, and then they all die.
It may have been the same prop piece. You don't know.
It could have been. they could have used more wire work in Xanadu, I suppose.
So eventually Olivia Newton-John shows up. She sings Xanadu, you know, and you know what? For all of that, and I watched this last night, I don't remember much of the actual Xanadu number itself. Is she roller skate? I don't think she even roller skates.
Well, that's what's interesting, right? Because when you see her, first you see her head, then it goes down to her shoulders, then it goes down to her waist, and I'm writing, wow, Olivia Newton-John looks really lovely. OMG, what is she wearing? Is that a harem pants jumpsuit with knee-high footless stockings, high-heeled shoes, and a gold belt? And there are scenes where everybody else is skating and she's skipping in her high-heeled shoes in the middle of the roller skating rink. I'm like, what is this? Who designed this? And how is she the muse of dance?
You know, she gets several costume changes during the Xanadu number. And I swear George Lucas didn't put his actresses in as torturous a bunch of costumes.
Well, I mean, that's the other thing. And so the other thing is there's the Xanadu song. Mm-hmm. And then there's
this. And the movie should end because that's her singing Xanadu. And you pull back and you think that's the end.
That's the end. Yeah.
And by the way, that's where it should really end. That's where it totally should have. There are so many things wrong with the end that we can delve into. But
that's where it should have been.
I want to throw out one thing as far as that's concerned, is that when she does the whole Xanadu thing, is she on that hydraulic lift at that point? Or was that at the very end? I think that's at the very end.
That's at the very end for the Xanadu reprise.
I'll save that for later then. But yeah, go ahead then.
So there's the Xanadu song. Then there are other musical numbers that each one more painful than the last. Mm-hmm. Then there's the Xanadu reprise. But in between those two things, we have to put up with a lot of stuff that we just shouldn't. Okay? I mean, the tap dance number, who was clamoring for that? Who was waiting for the shiny, sweaty, tiger print rock number? who wanted the country number? Who wanted that?
If anything doesn't belong in this movie, it's that.
And Kevin pointed out something I did not notice. Tell the audience,
Kevin, go ahead. Yeah.
What you noticed about the country number.
Oh, well, first of all, this movie wins several awards for its Netflix subtitling. there's a couple great mistakes in here, like they're quoting the poem Xanadu. They mis-subtitle decree as did create. the word franchise becomes French ice.
French ice? I thought you said it was French size.
And I checked and it was French ice.
French ice.
So clearly the subtitler was just listening to the audio and typing away. Well, so Olivia Newton-John is Australian and she's trying to sing a country song. And if you can't make out a single word she says, you're not alone, because the subtitler just gave up and wrote "sings country song."
That was fun.
Yeah, and you know what? That I would otherwise slam the stenographer, but in that case, that person was right. It boiled down to me like something like "Obese ma deputé" or something like that. I thought I heard at some point, but.
Yeah, it could have been.
Yeah.
I mean, you needed some ancient scrolls to translate the Australian to the country western to the English.
It's clearly some Gaelic offshoot or something. I'm not sure.
It was really weird. But the thing is, the Xanadu song, catchy, wonderful, I sing along. Mm-hmm. Then there's this other nonsense. Then there's more nonsense. Then we come for the Xanadu reprise, where she comes out in one outfit. Then they go back to those 1980s peasants outfit that were apparently all the rage on Mount Olympus. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And then she's there up on the pedestal, and then she ends again. And then, you know, you think it's over. I mean, it's annoying enough that you had those multiple musical numbers, but whatever. I guess they wanted to show how multi-talented she was, I guess. I don't know. But then, you know, then it's over, and then it's over. Okay, so if you didn't end it after the first time you ended Xanadu, end it now. No. They end it. She goes away, and then she's gone, and then she's back, but is it her? And she doesn't remember him? And then is it really her, or are they starting from scratch? Or does she remember him, but she's just screwing around with his head?
And now, and you think, oh, well, you know, this is a whole new story now. And that's where they end the film.
And so instead of the romantic kiss that you are expecting at the end of this film, we just get to watch these two talk to each other over the closing credits. And my follow-up question is, what could he possibly be saying that is so fascinating?
Let me just throw in one thing, because this was one of the little things that tickled me, is in that reprise of Xanadu, as you mentioned, she gets on this pedestal, which is supposed to rise her up. And it's supposed to be like sort of, you know, like in Metropolis, where Maria rises up above the audience and they all clamor for her and everything. So Olivia Newton-John rises up on this hydraulic pedestal, which lifts her a whole 3 feet off the floor.
Yes.
You know, and it's sort of let's say inadequate.
Well, Dan, we don't want her too high up, because otherwise we'd only be just staring at her leg warmers.
Might be a favor at that point. is there anything else we want to say about Xanadu?
If you read the Wikipedia entry and a few other places, you'll see that it's billed as a remake of the 1947 Rita Hayworth movie, Down to Earth. It really isn't. These two movies share one plot point, which is the Muse of Dance comes down to Earth and falls in love with a mortal. Other than that, they're nothing at all like each other. You can see Down to Earth on YouTube. It's fairly amusing. It makes this movie look like Citizen Kane. I mean, the level of emotional commitment and conflict that is evidenced in that film when compared to this is just astounding.
Wait. So you mean this film makes that film look like Citizen Kane?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I got
That's
a look in.
Good one,
I thought you were
saying
Xanadu look like Citizen Kane. I'm going,
sorry.
Wow, how bad could that film be?
Please God, no. Well, no. One other thing that we should mention about Xanadu before we go is that Xanadu is half of the double feature that inspired the Razzies.
Oh, yeah.
And the Razzie Awards were invented because the people who went on to invent the Razzies saw this double feature of a Xanadu with, for the love of God, please stop the music. That's what I like to call it. It's actually
the actual title is.
The actual title is Can't Stop the Music.
Thank you.
But my title is funnier. So it was a double feature of those two cinematic gems that inspired the creation of the Razzie Awards.
And I don't think Can't Stop the Music is on Netflix, is it?
No, it's not.
It used to be, and it isn't anymore. Yeah, you know that I know this because I would have nominated it otherwise.
Yeah, that's it. So, but you know what? We still have the Apple in our future. So
okay.
Behold and tremble for that. So in which case, if I think we've exhausted the topic, I think it's time for us to impart on the audience what we learned from this movie. So I think we'll go around because we've all learned at least a few things from this film. Andrea, do you want to start?
Yes. Despite all evidence to the contrary, including the evidence of my own eyes, Sonny Malone is incredibly handsome, charming, and charismatic.
Well, he
must be, because everybody acts like he is.
And a brilliant artist to boot.
Oh, with a great eye.
Yes. However, the other eye sucks. That's funny. It's with Kevin.
I learned just one thing, but it's really, really important, and that's if you want a totally swinging nightclub, you need to have tightrope walkers.
Worked for Circus. Andrea, it's you and me now. So mine is, if you're going to have a nostalgia trip about your time leading a big band, bring comfortable shoes because it's a long walk back to the flashback.
Muses have special powers over dictionaries and televisions.
If you're the star of the film, you've got the job. You can stop auditioning.
Hmm.
I'm a tiger girl. I'm a girl from the future. I'm a cowboy.
Ouch. Off-the-shoulder peasant dresses with slits up to there, enormous slouchy socks, and high-heeled shoes are all the rage on Mount Olympus.
And my final one is Australian accent plus Texas drawl equals CIA's new voice encryption filter.
And my last one is Olivia Newton-John is so multi-talented that she can carry the weight of an entire movie.
Just by default. Okay, and of course we need to finish up with the drinking game. Once again, we'll go around. Andrea, you start.
Take a drink every time Michael Beck looks stunned or confused.
Kevin?
Take a drink every time an inanimate object comes to life.
Every time you see a painting that would have been rejected by the starving artist market, take a drink.
Get ready. This is a biggie. Take a drink every time you hear the word Xanadu.
Oh, good Lord. What are you asking for, alcohol poisoning in the people?
Up to and including the final song.
Take a drink every time you see leg warmers.
Oh.
Every time you get an inside glimpse into the recording industry that clearly has nothing to do with the reality of the recording industry, take a drink.
Ha! I'm out.
Oh, okay. Kevin?
Take a drink every time somebody ignores a no trespassing sign.
That's a good one. Every time you have to suppress the urge to use binoculars to see what's going on, take a drink.
One more. We sort of talked about this, but take a drink every time you hear the whoosh sound.
I've got two more. Every time the glow around Olivia Newton-John gets so strong that you suspect she's about to get a Silkwood shower, take a drink.
Ouch.
And one more. Every time it becomes clear that the people who created Xanadu know more about the nightlife in Los Angeles circa late 1970s than they do about making movies, do two lines.
Nice.
Okay.
Yay.
That's it for Xanadu. And so before we go, let's let people know what we're going to be doing in the next show. I think it's my turn now, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And it better be good.
Yeah, I know. You know, I've been sweating over this for quite a while. I was I'm putting aside Baby Geniuses for now. I'll spare you that. I was sort of I wanted to do something more recent, but the one that I was looking at, Dylan Dog Dead of Night, might not be quite right for us. So, you know what? I'm going to go back to the period that we've been playing with for at least this show and with Sergeant Peppers. And this is something of a classic. It stars Marjo Gortner and David Hasselhoff with Christopher Plummer as the Emperor, because Christopher Plummer is always the Emperor. It's from 1978, Star Crash.
Yay! Woo! Woo!
It's available on Netflix, and boy, are you in for a treat.
Oh, man, is it a hoot.
So, before we go, Andrea, do you want to let people know what's going on at Be a Better Brook?
Yes, Porky.
That's all, folks.
You are all invited to swing by my website and podcast, which is called Be a Better Book Talker. It's a website. It's a blog. It's a podcast. You can subscribe on iTunes. Learn about books. Learn how to entice reluctant readers. Learn how to conduct class visits. And learn about all kinds of more books that you can shake a stick at.
And Kevin, what's going on with you?
You can go over to my blog at kevinlauderdale.livejournal.com. And once a month, I also do a very brief podcast on the Chronic Riff Network. You can go to chronicriff.com or just on iTunes. And it's called It Has Come to My Attention. It's about 10 minutes long, and it's a sort of a pop culture, generally genre-related, just things that have come to my attention. Books, movies, events. It's fun.
Okay, and my interview show, MightyMoviePodcast.com, is now over at ChronicRift.com, as well as MightyMoviePodcast.com and HuffingtonPost.com/Dan-Persons.
And our website. Tell them about our own, very own website.
Okay, let me wrap up with that, okay?
Yes.
Okay, because I just want to say, as far as Mighty Movie Podcast is concerned, the next show, which may already be up by the time this goes out, but will probably be up a couple of days after this show comes out, is an interview with Penn Ward of Adventure Time. And also, you can go to CineFantastiqueOnline.com and listen to the CineFantastique Spotlight, our weekly review show. And if you love, really love Temple of Bad, we now have a website, templeofbad.com, where you can go and just get the pure uncut shows without all that annoying interview and review stuff interceding. So that's it for the show, I think. So, Kevin Lauderdale, thanks for joining us.
I'll see you at a franchise Glitzy's.
I have no idea what that means. Andrea Lipinski, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Dan.
And I'm Dan Persons. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And remember, may a bad film be the worst thing to happen to you. You've got the safety. God was sleeping. I wonder if God was sleeping. I wonder if God was sleeping.